On today's episode of The Good Word, David Dennis Jr. joins us to talk about the Bulls fans booing Jerry Krause and his widow, the punishment and return of Draymond Green, and the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. All that and much more on today's episode of The Good Word.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports. Ball don't lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports, the host of this podcast. We are part of the Ball Don't Lie Network. Get us wherever you get your podcast. And of course, we are also on YouTube. And if you see us on YouTube, you see the light and bright face sitting next to me, my man, David Dennis Jr. And for purposes of today's podcast, the Jr. will be extremely emphasized. He is a senior writer at Anscape. He is an American Mosaic Journalism Prize recipient, and he is an author of The Movement Made Us, A Father, A Son, and the Legacy of a Freedom Ride. David, or should I? Yeah, David. I guess I'll call you David. Call you Dave. Thanks for joining me, man. Really, on this particular day, man. But really appreciate you joining.
Thanks for having me, man. I need to have you around with me at all times to give those introductions. Your mercurial voice, smooth, silky voice, giving an introduction, man, made me feel very prestigious.
Prestigious. I like that. Someone told me I should have been hosting like a Quiet Storm.
Yeah, man.
A Quiet Storm thing. Luckily, somehow it does not work on me in my single life. We're going to have to get to that as the Quiet Storm voice. That don't get me out of no trouble.
Yeah, you got to work on that. Donnie Simpson's about to retire, man. You can take his place, man. Come on now.
Yeah, I saw that, but they not paying him, right?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about all that.
Apparently, he was walking off, he was like, you know, if they can't afford to keep you, then you walk away. I was like, okay, we got it.
Okay. They might not be paying that Vince Goodwill money. You know what I'm saying?
No, probably not. I'm a little too expensive. Yeah. I'm a little too expensive. But David Dennis, of course, is joining us today. It's actually the day is normally commemorated as, you know, the third Monday or second Monday in January. But today is the actual day, January 15th. It would have been the 95th birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King, of course. And for those who don't know, the David Dennis Jr. goes into David Dennis Sr., who was a critical part of everything that was going on in the movement. If you've ever been to the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, which is not too far from FedEx Arena, which is actually at the Lorraine Motel, which is where Dr. King was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. There's a lot of photos there. And one of those photos, and I didn't know that David Dennis Sr.'s father was going to be photoed there. I'm going through the tour last year for the first time in my life, and I'm seeing this picture. I'm like, why does this dude look so familiar? So I just take a picture of it. And I'm like, I look at it for like 3 seconds and I'm like, and this is a black people thing, like, boy, you look just like your daddy. So David Dennis Sr. was a critical part of that. And even just before we go to the basketball, because David Dennis Jr. is connected to one of the most iconic stars of today. But just even before we get into some of the other stuff, David, what is it like being the son of someone so critical that your dad isn't just a black and white photo like we've seen in so many different, you know, remembrances this time of year, that he's a flesh and blood human being that can teach you and talk to you, and he's actually someone real.
I mean, that's it. You nailed it. I mean, it's the realness. It's the fact that these people, you know, when we see them in the books and the history books, or however many history books we have left in classrooms that are allowing us to read about these things, we see these stories, and we see these stories of people, and sometimes they feel larger than life, right? And they feel like people who, well, I can't do that. This person dedicated their whole life, and they had this life calling, and they sacrificed and all that stuff. That's not totally the truth of what a lot of the story is with a lot of these people. A lot of these folks are just like you and I. First of all, they're young. My dad was 20 to 23 in the time period of the book of The Movement Made Us, 1961 to 64. He was 20 to 23 years old. He was basically a kid in college. And there was a lot of college kids out there. Like, you know, you think about somebody like Bob Moses, who was 26. He was the elder in the group, right, at that age. So you got to remember that these folks were young. But also, a lot of these people were just folks, men and women, who were just trying to go about their lives. And a lot of times they got in the movement because somebody, you know, impacted their lives either positively to get them involved or negatively to make them feel like they wanted to have a change. These people were, you know, college students, they were drivers, they were, you know, working in offshore, they were just doing things that they felt like could, you know, further their lives. And then this movement called them. So I grew up with my dad, with friends like, you know, with Hollis Watkins, with Bob Moses, with Uvester Simpson, with people like that who just, you know, told these stories. And I felt like, oh, well, this is possible for me because like, they're just like I am, you know, like I'm not reading them in a book. I'm seeing their story. I'm seeing the real story. I'm hearing the fact that, yeah, they were scared just like I was, that I would be in that situation. They had exams to take. They were trying to go on a ride, you know, put their life in danger because they had a date that they were trying to get to. You know, all this stuff that really makes it feel real, makes it feel like something that's attainable and something that we could do. And on top of that, something that we could actually be successful in.
Yeah. And it's an important part. Guys, and we're going to get back to this. I'm going to bounce around a little bit, but it was something that I really noted during the tour in Memphis. And it was like emotions that hit me. And it was something that hit me about Dr. King after all these years of reading and learning about him, everything else. And I'm going to get to that later. But David, for those who don't know, where did you go to college?
I went to college at the Davidson College, the, you know, premier collegiate institute in North Carolina.
Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot to be said there. You said the premier.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, I'm gonna let the Dukies and the Tar Heels work that out. And y'all can go find David Dennis on Twitter and mm-hmm. Instagram. And y'all can go tell him what y'all think. But yes, he went to Davidson College, the same college as the one Stephen Curry.
Yep.
Now, Friday night, Steph was in attendance, David, when the Bulls did their inaugural Ring of Honor class,
yeah,
where they wanted to bring back everybody from the 96 Bulls and, you know, prominent members of their franchise history to celebrate them and honor them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one person who could not be there was Jerry Krause, the former GM, the former architect of 6 championship teams. He died in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
His widow was there. They booed her. I've never seen anything like that in my life, okay? They booed her. And the reason that they booed the Krause family or anything else is A, ridiculously stupid, but I think for purposes of this conversation, Dave, you see where I'm going with this. Or David, you see where I'm going with this. Jerry Krause did not want the Michael Jordan Bulls to look like today's Golden State Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
A team that is removed, not far removed from a championship, but has, as presently constituted, I'm sure you can agree with me, no chance of winning a championship right now. And as someone who's watched Steph Curry when, you know, obviously you went to college together, you saw the rise and everything else. How do you view Golden State? How do you view even Steph going through where this is, this stage that Golden State is in? Draymond Green is coming back today. They're playing at Memphis, actually. But how do you think, from what you know about Steph or how close you've been with Steph, how do you think he's handling all of this?
Let me say this first about this whole Chicago Bulls thing. Like that's like absolute clown behavior. That's like Twitter hive mind behavior, like a lack of critical thinking of just because Michael Jordan tells you to hate this guy, that you're just going to hate this guy who, you know, got you 6 rings. Like there are a lot of owners who deserve to be booed, even posthumously booed. And these owners, a lot of times, are owners who took franchises away from cities, who, you know, devastated, you know, communities and did things like that. Like those people, that is what reserved for those people. But this man passed away, his widow was there, and you were booing him because you watched a 10-hour documentary from Michael Jordan's perspective and you felt like he destroyed a dynasty. That, like, it's a dynasty. You know, man, it was a 6, like, how many more championships did you actually think that those Bulls teams were going to win beyond those 6? If you watch also that same that document that trashed them, they were kind of at the end of that rope.
They were done.
Anyway, they were pretty much done. Dennis Rodman, and I'm bringing it back to the parallels. Like, Dennis Rodman was at that place where we're seeing Draymond at right now, where it's like all the outside antics, all that stuff was outweighing the productivity. Because just look at the rest of his career. Look at the Lakers tenure, the Mavericks tenure. Like, we forgot about that time, right? Look at Pippen. Pippen was still good, but he never, you know, that Blazers team, choked, you know, in 2000. And, you know, Michael Jordan, who knows what else, what he had left. And you're right. That team could have looked a lot like this Warriors team looks this year. Now, back to your original thing with Stephen and all that stuff. I mean, this dude, I think, has the belief, like his you know, ability to believe in himself, believe these things. You said the Warriors have no chance to win a championship. I don't think this dude feels like they don't have a chance to win a championship. You know, that's the thing about it. I think that we've seen a little bit of him talking about the fact that, yes, at, you know, the deadline, they need to make some moves. They got to figure out what this Kuminga and Wiggins thing, like why they can't play together. We got to figure out what Clay still has and why he's playing like he's playing. And Draymond has to come back. Chris Paul is out there. I think there are some moves that need to be made. But what I've seen from this dude, who, you know, was the smallest kid on the court his freshman year and was busting these teams, scoring 30 points a game, the team that beat Gonzaga, the team, you know, the dude who beat Georgetown, the dude who beat LeBron in the finals, all this stuff that people were saying was impossible. If I'm going to Monday morning quarterback, or, you know, couch, you know, analyze this dude, I think this guy's looking at this squad and saying, look, we make one move, we're going to turn this thing around.
I don't even think you're wrong on that, right? Because you look at Minnesota, you look at Oklahoma City, Memphis is clearly out of it because Ja Morant is out for the rest of the season. Desmond Bane out for 6 weeks at least with an ankle sprain. So they're done for this year. The Warriors still, they have parts, right? Like, that's the, if I'm a Warriors fan, I'm frustrated at being, you know, below 500 and being on the outside looking in of even the play-in right now, which I think it, of course, can change in like a good week. Like, Stephen can just go on a heater and they'll be, you know, right in the thick of things. But you look at Jonathan Kuminga, you look at Moses Moody when he's gotten the time. Like, Andrew Wiggins, that's the thing I can't figure out. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, it's a weird thing.
Yeah.
But with Golden State, you feel like there is a move there. You just can't figure out. You don't know what the move is. Is it Pascal Siakam? Mm. Is it a guy like Nikola Vucevic? Is it somebody that is not necessarily an all-star, but an all-star talent that can help unlock and alleviate the rest of the concerns? And it may not put you back in the finals, but I do think a guy like Steph, all he wants is a chance.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think like part of it is just, there, I mean, there's the elephant in the room is the Kerr-ness of it. And like, we're going to bring this back to the Bulls, is that Phil Jackson knew how to put a team that was right there on the cusp and get them over the hump, right? Mm-hmm. He's not a Greg Popovich who can take a team that is, you know, not that great and raise their ceiling to, you know, do something. Like, Phil Jackson never could do that. And I think Steve Kerr comes sort of from that tree, because Steve Kerr is having to do some of the things that, like, traditional coaches have to do when you don't have a team that's on the cusp. Like, you have to figure some things out with your rotations, when to play people, when to bench them. Because a lot of these moves that have been made and a lot of these blown leads have been Steve Kerr just not knowing how to manage game-to-game situations. I think he's genius and brilliant when it comes to, here's our rotation, we're going to figure out rotation, we're going to try out this rotation every game, and that's going to win us, make or break it. But in-game situations, in-game changes, the things that you do that he's doing, keeping Kuminga out for the last 17 minutes of a game when he's when he's the best player on the court, not playing Moody, not knowing what to do with Kuminga and Wiggins, playing the small ball, not knowing when to put Looney in or take Looney out, like not being able to figure this in game is really Steve Kerr's weakness. And that is being really, really exploited right now, especially when he does not have the type of, you know, assistant like he had with Mike Brown, who is actually really, really good at doing those things.
You need coaches that can do the micro and you need coaches who can be the macro, right? Mm-hmm. You need the big picture guys and you need the small picture, all the details. I think Kerr is really good at organizational ethos, keeping the eye on the bigger picture. This is how we want to play, the whole everything playing with joy, unlocking Steph, unlocking Klay Thompson. That changed the trajectory of NBA history, not just for that franchise, but for the way that the game has been played over the past 10 years. The stuff that you're talking about is digging into the details. Mm-hmm. It is. We saw it in the 2016 finals where Ty Lue ran circles around him.
Yeah.
And to be clear, Steve Kerr's become a better coach since 2016.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a couple of those, you know, blind spots, including the return of Draymond Green, right? Yeah. And you wrote this fabulous column not too long ago, circled around both Draymond Green and Ja Morant and our, I guess you could say, our obsession with punishment.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the punishment culture. And I almost in some way feel like it's almost tied to the way that we look at like the jail system or the prison system, so to speak. And it's sport and it's not sport, but you understand what I'm saying here.
Right.
Is that, are we worried about players just being able to get back on the floor and entertaining us because they have besmirched the shield of the league, so to speak?
Right.
Or do we want them to become better people, better citizens, which is a lot murkier? It's almost like you're saying, hey, y'all, let's be honest about what we want here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, and I want to do the big picture thing here is that we have an obsession with punishment culture, right? Like we, and that is directly tied to the prison. Tied to the prison industrial complex, because in order to get people on board with something like that, you have to convince them that it's good. It's a societal good to send people to jail, right? And part of convincing people that it's a societal good is convincing people that that is part of rehabilitation, because you send them to jail and they come out a different person, right? But as we've learned, like, that is not the case, right? You're not fundamental. When you send somebody to jail, you're not fundamentally changing their socioeconomic status when they get out. You're not changing anything about, you know, their outlook on life or how they go about life. And actually what you're doing, you're further traumatizing them and making it more likely that they do end up back in jail. And it's not a problem with the person. It's a problem with the system that we have in itself, right? And so the NBA and all these leagues, actually, it's not just the NBA, it's NFL, all these leagues, when you try to create some sort of facsimile of that system in which I'm going to punish you, and then that's going to be your rehabilitation. You actually create a system in which you just punish people and you expect them to come back better, right? But I have no, like, there's nothing about what happened to Draymond or what happened to Ja Morant that makes me feel like they're going to come back any different, except for the fact that they're going to come back and not get caught doing the things that they did, right? Like Ja Morant, if your problem, the NBA still has not really determined if Ja Morant's issue, right, is the fact that he has guns and loves guns, or is it the fact that he waved a gun on social media, right? So if your problem is the latter, then Ja Morant, he's already not done it. He hasn't done it in 9 months. He hasn't waved a gun on social media. Problem solved, right? If you have an issue with him with guns, then that's a whole nother thing, because we live in America, brother, and it's going to be hard to convince somebody not to love guns in America, right? And so Draymond, by the same token, like, what is the punishment going to do to stop him from going from losing his temper and choking somebody or hitting somebody? He's already, I would say, suffered the worst punishment that he could possibly have for doing that, because he blew his team's chance at being the greatest team of all time, right? So 10 games, 12 games is a drop in the bucket for the fact that 7 years ago, he derailed that franchise. You know, they got Durant and everything, you know, was, you know, better after that, but he blew the chance of being the best, you know, team, and he has to carry that. And he's still doing those things. So what is punishment actually going to do to change any of that?
I don't know how you change behavior. Like, when the Ja Morant thing pops up, and anybody who's listened to this podcast knows where I'm going with this, I just said, dude, just stop playing with guns and telling the world that you're playing with guns. Like, I'm not going to tell you how to kick it with guns. I'm not a gun person, but like you said, this is a gun culture. My general thing with the league on that was, if you didn't step in when you heard about him beating up a kid in his backyard,
right?
That's where I look at the league and I'm like, hey, y'all, the warning signs were up well before this. Right. And yeah, if we're concerned about Ja Morant's quote unquote mental health, then figuring out how to breathe when you're being stressed out. All right, cool. That, if that's the way y'all want to play it, cool. But to the people, because there's different elements of this. It's us as a media and what we want. There's the league and what it wants. And there's the fans. And the fans have to also be very honest about what they want as well, right?
Right.
I'm not sure if the fans care. If the fans believe that the NBA has it in for Ja freaking Morant, a an American face in an increasingly international game, right? A young American face in an increasingly international game. Y'all are tripping. Y'all don't know how this works. They need an American face to help carry this into the next generation. And Ja Morant and Anthony Edwards, to who's elevated himself over the past, you know, over the past year. So those are your best hopes.
Right.
Maybe until, you know, Cooper Flagg comes into the game and does what he does, because he's got all the advantages, right?
Mm.
But your point is well taken, David, is that what is the league's obligation? Is it to create better citizens, or is it to make money?
Yeah, I mean, going back to the thing you said about mental health, you know what's not good for my mental health? Taking away 1/4 of my paycheck. That's not good for my mental health at all. So don't tell me that you're concerned about my mental health while taking my money. You know what I'm saying? Like, what is it that the punishment has to do with the like, if you're going to put Ja Morant in therapy and Draymond in therapy, why do you have to take him away from the games in order to do that? Right. And they have not figured that out. Like, I could do therapy while playing these games. I could do therapy before, but don't act like your main focus is rehabilitation. You also want to punish these dudes because you want to look at all these fans and advertisers and say, we're punishing these people for fighting and having guns. Now, the league's obligation to all that, league has no obligation. They don't have none. Right. They can punish and just say, I don't like what you did. You're gone. I don't like that. But the problem is when the league and the part of their messaging is we want to make this right. When you put out Joe Dumars on First Take and he's like, we're mostly concerned with Draymond Green's health and we're not concerned with punishment. Like, then you put yourself as an organization that is fully focused on trying to make these dudes, you know, rehabilitate and make these dudes' mental health and all that stuff better. But if I'm Draymond Green and you're telling me I get to come back whenever I get to get my paycheck back when my mental health is better, I'm telling you after game three, I'm like, therapy has worked, brother. I'm back. So what is my motivation? Is Draymond Green coming back saying, ah, that helped and I feel like a better person? Or is Draymond Green coming back saying, look, I want my money back?
Yeah, it's a lot. And to be perfectly honest, I'm not coming here from the ivory tower saying I have the answers. And
yeah,
I don't think
yeah.
you are. I don't think you are
no,
either.
Yeah.
When Draymond Green choking people out and hit people in the face, it is clear he does not need to be playing basketball until he gets some things, you know, right internally.
Right.
And to some degree, if you wanted to say that it stemmed from incidents well before it got to this point, 100% with you. Mm-hmm. If you want to say there was no accountability with the Jordan Poole situation because he wasn't actually suspended, he just took some time away.
Yeah.
I'm 100% with you. I just don't know what the answer is. And I get, and for those who don't know, Joe Dumars is Joe Dumars is a father figure for Draymond Green. Jordan Dumars and Draymond Green. Jordan is Joe's son. They grew up together.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a, you know, father, surrogate father, son relationship there that he has to balance against his role. So when he says that, you know, we want Draymond to get better, I'm 100% with him in his intentions. I just don't know what the particular answer is when you put money into the equation.
Right.
That said, David, Dennis, what do you expect to see when Draymond comes back? Because it felt like, to some degree, it was necessary space between the Golden State Warriors and Draymond Green. Keeping in mind, the Golden State Warriors were also part of this quote unquote punishment process. They were not out of it. They weren't on the outside looking in. Maybe they felt like they needed some space in this relationship. And they've been 8-8 in this absence. And now I feel like there's more questions for Steve Kerr to answer, more questions for Jonathan Kuminga, more questions for Stephen Curry. Where do the Warriors as a franchise go from here?
I mean, I think my hope is that Draymond is finding some sort of peace now, you know, because what was interesting about sort of the conversation about Draymond, even before the suspension, there seemed to be like genuine concern from the Warriors and around the league, just the way they were talking, genuine concern about how this dude was doing. Now, I don't know. I don't know what is going on. I don't know specifically. There seemed to be like actual worry about what he was going through, whether it's just, you know, dealing with, you know, the, you know, you not being as good and you, you know, where the stuff goes, things that take a toll on you mentally. Something was sort of you know, causing concern for folks. So that's something that I hope that Draymond can work out. But also on the court, you know, my hope is that, I mean, Draymond has not seemed to be the same since the Jordan Poole thing. You know, he's been sort of having to figure out how intense he needs to be, where that sort of nozzle needs to be between like overboard and like too subtle and all that stuff. So hopefully he can find that middle ground, and hopefully his mental acumen, which is very underrated and understated about him, can help them figure out some of these rotations. Maybe he can unlock the Wiggins-Kuminga conundrum that they got going on. Maybe he can help figure out when Looney gets to play. And it's possible that he could also, you know, carry the load a little bit for ball handling and get Steph a little bit more wide open shots. Like he can sort of, that like if he is in this position where he's looking at himself and saying, I have almost derailed this season, this is the third season in which, third or fourth season that I've almost sort of imploded single-handedly, well, not single-handedly, but I've had a hand in, you know, imploding. How can I make this right? And if he can sort of do that in combination with a very necessary trade that needs to happen in a couple weeks, you know, this can be a net positive for the Warriors.
It's like you said, the trade deadline, I believe, is like February 7th. So somewhere around like 10 games between, for most teams, 10 games between now and then. That's usually like standard. I don't know if they realize that they have an opportunity in front of them. And you have to also take into account that this is a luxury tax apron kind of world.
Yeah.
While also taking into account there's only one Steph Curry walking the face of the earth. There's some imposters, but there's only one of those dudes. And Steph is going to be 36?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, born in 88. So he'll be 36 in March, which means the best of the rest of Stephen Curry, you're going to really have to maximize. And you're going to have to, you know, look, LeBron got Anthony Davis, y'all.
Right.
Like,
right.
I did tend to laugh, David, when I was covering the Western Conference semis last year. And everybody was saying, it's LeBron versus Steph. And I'm like, do you see that big, long-armed, walking 2020 dude standing right behind LeBron? Like, that's a difference maker. It's not just one-to-one. And Steph, maybe he's being punished because he played with Kevin Durant for 3 years. He doesn't have that guy with him. He has more or less a conglomerate as opposed to that guy. Do you think the Warriors kind of need to find another all-star, that guy level of player? Or is it just maybe we just need to tweak something with Draymond being back?
They can look for that all-star guy. I don't know how the Warriors can afford anybody right now. I don't know. The apron stuff. You know what I'm saying? I'm not smart enough for that stuff, but I know them brothers broke. and so it is hard to think about how a superstar can fit in there financially. I think Siakam is probably the closest that they can get. With the Warriors and maximizing these step years, as you mentioned, they're going to have to look at and do a postmortem on this building the future while building the present thing that they did. Like, this can be one of those, like, you want to talk about what Jerry Krause did and all that stuff. You want to talk about ownership sort of, you know, putting a kibosh on a dynasty. And that is the fact that you have Wiseman, Moody, Kuminga, Poole, right? Wiseman is gone for Gary Payton the second. Poole is gone essentially for, you know, a 50-year-old Chris Paul. And you may be getting rid of Kuminga and or Moody in a couple of weeks, right? And what do you have to show for it? Like, that is something that the Warriors are going to have to reckon with. But there's no way that they can get a star back on that roster with the situation that they have. They can just hope that they have one player that sort of unlocks something for that roster.
Yeah, and I don't know exactly who that player is or whatever it is. And thanks to producer John, trade deadline is not the 7th. It is the 8th, February 8th. So my bad on that, y'all. But your point is well taken. They could just very well be, the ceiling could be, get me, and as a player like Steph is more so, get me to game 5 of a second round series.
Yeah.
Where it's a 2-2 series, and if I'm on your home floor, I can steal the game. We've seen him do it in Sacramento in a game 7 where he put up a 50 ball. I think that's what he's looking for, is just a chance. Put me in a spot where maybe I can help carry us over the top, and then maybe, you know, chance can sort of, you know, carry the day. I think that's unlikely. But I am not a world-class athlete. I am not as delusional as some of these guys have to be to get to where they are.
I mean, Steph was a one Lonnie Walker fourth quarter away from just exactly that happening. And the fact that Lonnie Walker, that he not didn't have anybody on the Warriors team and that whole playoff run and maybe the playoff run before then who could put a one quarter together like Lonnie Walker did in that game says a lot about that roster that they constructed around Steph.
When Lonnie Walker hit that elbow extended jumper, mm-hmm. and that might have been like his second one, was it game four, I think?
Yeah.
And Steph turned and looked at him like, mm-hmm. where did you come from?
Right, right.
You know who else was giving Lonnie Walker the fourth that look? Me.
Right.
Because I had the line of sight. Like, did he just do an in and out in a pool?
Yeah.
I didn't know he had that in the repertoire.
Right, yeah.
Much respect. But where the hell did that come from? I get it. Totally get it. And I'm like, if I'm Steph, I'm like, seriously, dog? Like Jordan Poole, you got nothing for me today?
Right.
Klay, you have nothing for me this entire series? I get the frustration. That's all I'm going to say. I get the frustration.
He might have been looking at Steve Kerr like, this is what happens when you know, Steve Kerr might have benched Lonnie Walker after hitting that second shot for the rest of the game.
it's time for Lonnie Walker's rotation to end. So we're going to pull them. The note card says at 8:25 in the fourth quarter, it is time to pull him out and put somebody else back in. No matter if he cook it, that is the hilarious part of all this stuff. Some of the robotic nature of coaches, but of course, David. One of the reasons that I wanted to bring you on today is because you know it's Dr. King's birthday. And as people have wrote last year that I went to Memphis to the Lorraine Motel, the Civil Rights Museum and everything that is there. And for purposes of that, of course, civil rights did not start in slavery, but at the museum, that's kind of where they begin, you know, the exhibit. And I don't know if you've ever been there before.
So I'm going to date myself here. I was at the opening of that museum when I was like 2 years old.
Oh, wow.
I think the museum might have opened and it was the late 80s. My dad, of course, was invited to that. So I was able to go there and I met Rosa Parks. I met all sort of the luminaries of the movement and all those folks at the time. So I went then. I went a couple more times as a kid. I was supposed to go there and do a speaking thing last year, I believe, for the book. And it actually snowed in Memphis. It snowed out in Memphis, so I couldn't make it out there. It was kind of crazy.
I'm always, David, fascinated. I used to get infuriated on this day. Because this day, I would say to my friends, is like the most disingenuous day on the calendar.
Right.
Out of all the days, this is more fictional than Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny, all right? And the Tooth Fairy put together. This is the day where all of the companies and all of the politicians who try to strip away everything that's the essence of Dr. King and people of that time, and they try to sanitize them and co-opt their words to fit their agendas. They put out the quotes, the tweets, and all that stuff. Dr. King said, you know, you shouldn't judge someone by the color of their skin, not the content of their character. That's why we should no longer have DEI.
Right, right, right.
My question to you is, how does that hit you? How hypocritical, as someone who's seen it and heard it and felt it and written a book about it, how does that hit you personally?
You know, I try to stay off of, for the most part, social media on MLK Day. And if I can, for the most of the month of February, when everybody sends their product placement, Black History Month, colors to do whatever they got. You know what I'm saying? Whatever candy bar they're putting on the African flag or whatever they do. Because it is disingenuous. When you have the FBI, right, who tail this man, who tried to ruin this man's life, the FBI sending out, hey, happy MLK Day, and putting a quote there, we have lost the plot, right? And so all of those things, you know, for me, I try to lean into the people who, you know, embody the message, the people who are still here, the ancestors, the folks who knew him, the folks who loved him, his children, all that stuff. Those are people I try to think about on today. And I try to cut out the noise of the disingenuous folks who, you know, because that's what you do. They will kill you and rewrite your story, right? That is how the that's how history works. That's how history books work. That's how we ban books that tell you anything different and all that stuff. They will murder you, and then they will tell you that you enjoyed being murdered as after you were dead, right? And that's essentially what they try to do on MLK Day. And I think it's you know, a powerful thing that we can do to take that story back and make that story ours.
You know, the weird thing for me, Dave, and it's funny that you brought that part of that we make it, oh, say we, that the writers of this, and I don't mean writers like journalists, I mean like the authors of some of these stories, try to make it seem like Dr. King was a willing martyr, or people of that time were willing martyrs. When I went to the Civil Rights Museum last year, it struck me. And I want to say it struck me for the first time. And maybe it was a picture of your dad because he looked so much like you. I'm not saying it's a flattery. I'm just saying it. I think this when it hit me that, and you brought it up earlier, these were regular people just doing extraordinary things. He said in one of his final speeches, "I have no martyr complex. I want to live as long as I can." And that thing, because you haven't been there, it's playing in the background of like one of the final exhibits before you go to the final hotel room. And the picture where your dad is in, and I know it wasn't there then because technology wasn't as good. It's the lunch counter. And it's a photo of your dad, and next to you, the photo of your dad who's on the bus where the bus is being occupied. And for those on YouTube, you might be able to see it if we can get, you know, if we can get the copyright up. But it's a photo of your dad, and there's an officer next to him with a long rifle, a shotgun. And inside the exhibit, it is a simulated lunch counter situation where kids of that time who were part of the movement were being shown, this is what it's going to be like. When you go to the lunch counter to integrate these lunch counters, you're going to have stuff thrown at you. You're going to have stuff being said to you. And you have to be able to handle it. So what's playing over it is the things that they were going to have to hear before they went to integrate the segregated lunch counters, and how they would have to hear those things and deal with them and not respond and not react and everything else. So I come back to the point, David, of I was angry when I left that place. I was angry when I went onto that balcony, the balcony, the infamous balcony where Dr. King was assassinated. Like, this man wanted to live, and they took him. Whoever they were, they took him. And that to me is like one of those things that out of all these years I've been reading about Dr. King, you read the letter from a Birmingham jail, which I'm going to get to and tie to the NBA in a way and see if you rock with me there. But David, that's what hit me, was the frustration and the anger, like the searing anger that this man wanted to live and they took him.
Yeah, that's one of the things that struck me in working on the book is that, you know, my dad was best friends with Medgar Evers, right?
Yeah.
And was with Medgar Evers the night before he was assassinated. And, you know, Medgar Evers had plans, right? He had plans to do things, not even grand civil rights plans. Like, he had plans to go get ice cream next week. You know what I'm saying? Like, he had plans to do things. And I think one of the things that, you know, the folks who try to write the story will tell you is that Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, all these folks gave their lives. Their lives were taken from them, right? And nobody really gives their life. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, all these folks, they had children, right? They had children. They wanted to watch their children grow old, right? My dad was lucky enough to watch me grow to the age that I am. These people do not have that, right? These children are not able to write books with their parents because their parents were taken away from them when they were little. So nobody is actually giving their life to the movement. Their lives were taken by people who did not want them to live because their lives that they lived and what they wanted was, you know, the antithesis of what these people stood for, right? Which was, you know, hatred and oppression and all that stuff. And their lives were testimonies to the fact that we don't have to live that way. In order to, you know, silence that, you snuff those people out. And so then you tell the story about how they gave their lives instead of taking ownership of the fact you took those lives away.
Yeah, I mean, even one of those quotes that, you know, you'll never see out here is very simple from Dr. King. He says, I'm tired. I'm tired of marching for what should have been mine at birth. Like, it's so simple, David, but when you put it that way, and he had this amazing clarity that you cannot misconstrue his words unless you actually want to, unless you are a willing participant in this sanitizing of it, cleansing of it. And I think about, David, a letter from a Birmingham jail where he talked about the quote unquote white moderate. And this is where I bring it back to the NBA. And Bomani Jones, a friend of ours, has this great thing where he said this years ago. He said King's greatest weapon was shame, where his appeal to white people of the time was, you're not as bad as you're acting. Like, you should feel ashamed of how you are treating your fellow man. You are not the way that you are comporting yourself to be, right? After a while, I started to think, man, we ain't got no shame at all. You know, like, maybe they had shame back then, but, you know, some events that have happened over the past 8 years, I'm like, man, ain't no shame out here. So David, I bring it to David Stern of the 80s when he took over as commissioner in the 83-84 season. He took office, I believe, in February of 84. I believe that David Stern's ethos in promoting the NBA to the quote-unquote white moderate fan and the white moderate sort of promoter of the league was, you're not as racist as you think you are in this black league. You can take Magic. You can take Michael. You can take Isaiah Thomas. You can take Julius Erving, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You will welcome them into your homes because you're not as bad as you think you are. They will have equity. They are not going to scare you. They can entertain you. You know what I mean? I felt like it was a morsel of that ethos that carried. Not saying that they are similar or anything alike. David Stern is David Stern, and Dr. King is one of the greatest humans who's ever walked the earth. But I'm just saying, as far as an NBA tie that helped grow the league, I felt like that ethos was there.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, you got to have that sort of that walk in that fine line when you're bringing black folks to the white folks' homes. You know, the NBA is the only league that's majority black players and audience, right? And so, you know, there's all that. But at the same token, David Stern said, y'all better wear some suit and ties when y'all come when y'all show up to this arena. You know, so there is a lot of that.
Was he right about that, though? Because I thought it was inherently racist when he did it. And then I'm like a couple years later, once I remove my, I'm like, it kind of worked.
Nah, man. I'm anti dress code in general. Okay. I'm anti dress code. I'm especially anti dress code for black folks in black spaces, right? Because here's the thing is that, like, white folks will hate you. They will find a way to hate you no matter what if they
absolutely
actually hate you.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? So that suit and that tie won't matter anything because you're going to talk about my tattoos, right?
Right.
The suit, the tattoos, we cover up the tattoos, you're going to talk about my hair. We cover up the hair, you're going to talk about how I talk. That line is always going to move in the direction.
The goalposts
will always move. So I was not a big fan of the dress. Now, understand from his standpoint why he was trying to do that when you got brothers, you know, running up into the stands and you feel like that has something to do with that. And to be fair, at the time, you also had some, you know, black support for this sort of thing because there is the respectability politics of it all that's sort of baked into a lot of this stuff.
Right, right.
Also, you know, so there has been, you know, this issue of what it means to have to have these black face and these black players in these white homes in a way that's pretty much exclusive to the NBA. And because, you know, you have the NFLs in everybody's home, but in the NFL, you could still trot out your Tom Brady's mm-hmm. and your Drew Brees's and all that mm-hmm. stuff. And, you know, actually the playground where this stuff is actually at its most interesting is the WNBA, right? Where you have all of these, you know, this black women league and the shoe deals are all white women. Video game covers are all white women, you know, and the people who are getting commercials for the most point are white women when the best player in the league last season, and the most charismatic person in the league is Agent Wilson. I'm trying to figure out why she's not on everybody's TV screen right now as the corporate head of the WNBA. So that is sort of the space where this is becoming like one of the more interesting things, especially because the WNBA is leading the charge at all the political activism that the NBA eventually follows.
Yeah, it's the WNBA is the, like, it's like the breeding ground. Like, they dip their toe. Like, oh, it's not the WNBA is doing it at the behest of the NBA. Mm. They're doing it because they want to. And the NBA is saying, well, we'll let them dip their toe into it. And then we will figure out if we want to follow them.
Right.
They're taking all the risk.
Right.
Right? They're taking all the risk, even though they don't have as much to lose per se, because, you know, the salaries aren't as high, but they have more to lose because you can lose your livelihood without having that to fall back on.
By the way, is very consistent with how Black liberation movements work in this country in general.
Yeah. And to your point about the dress code, there's plenty of times that Dr. King was in suits and people were behind him in suits and dressed to the nines and head thrown at him.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like, so that didn't matter. I do think that David Stern used the malice at the palace and used Allen Iverson and used some of those people as examples to enact changes that he probably always wanted to do.
And to your point, to bring it to full circle, that's not very different from Adam Silver feeling like he needed to suspend a Black man who's got a gun on Instagram. Like that, there's that piece of it also, right? Is like who are you appeasing to when you're suspending Ja Morant? Because there is the question of what does this happen? What, you know, does this same thing happen if, you know, Jokic is on a horse with a shotgun? You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, like there's that conversation too. Now, I don't think that is central to the reason that Ja Morant is suspended, but that part does become part, that is at least some part of the conversation.
It is a weird thing because I think we can all say this because we're Black men of a certain age. I feel like you're probably maybe a couple of years younger than me, even though I feel like you should be a couple of years older than me. But
I'm just a wise man, brother.
That's what it is. I'll take it. And light skins usually don't age as well as you do, so you're good.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I got a skin regimen. I got a skincare regimen on. I got my ring light on. That Fenty is got my skin popping, brother.
See, this is always going to devolve into some level of nonsense whenever we have somebody like this on this podcast. But what I was going to say was, David, when I saw Ja Morant with the gun, you know, my first thought was not, oh, man, you're going to be suspended. My thought was, David, and I'm betting you it was yours. Fool, what is you doing with the tool on Instagram when you know everybody is watching you? The thought, I don't think, was the gun. It was the stupidity of showing the gun and not exercising some level of discretion with it.
Yeah, my concern is always when I see somebody doing something that's irresponsible with a gun, that worries me. You know, now he was not shooting the gun in the air or doing anything like that. But if you were doing something that is against your best judgment, that's not great. If you're doing something that's against your best judgment and you got a gun in your hand, that's really bad. You know, so that was the thing that concerned me. I was concerned about him, his well-being, mm-hmm. because you're in Memphis, you're in different places. You are, you know, a lot of times guns are not necessarily deterrence. They are reconnaissance. Right. And so that was a problem. That stuff worried me. I was just worried about him and his well-being more so than anything.
Yeah. And once again, Memphis, look, they don't play with guns in Memphis. They use guns in Memphis, and for whatever the reason, they killed rapper Young Dolph in Memphis. He was going to get what, cookies or something. You know what I mean? Like, this is what happens. And there is a almost paternal feeling. Like, I'm not an old Black man. I promise you, I'm nobody's granddaddy. Right. I'm one person's uncle, so to speak, or a few people's uncles. But you almost come across paternal.
You're the uncle of the sports journalism game, man.
Don't not see
everybody. All these people's your sons, man. That's what.
Don't do gotta, that. I'm not Michael Wilbon. Michael Wilbon is like the godfather. I am still like one of the nephews. You know what
okay.
I mean? Like, we are still young enough to be the young generation, even though we're not young no more. You know what I mean? But the paternal thing always pops up, and it's not like a respectability thing. It's like, man, look at these white folks. These white folks don't think about you. They don't think whatever they're going to think about you anyway. That ain't really going to change. But it's like you said, it's the matter of, hey, man, what you doing? That's how I felt about Draymond hitting Yusuf Nurkic in the face. Not about you won't get suspended. It's like, hey, man, what you doing? What I hear from older players, or what I've heard from older players who have retired, like the Isaiah Thomases of the world and those guys from that generation. What I've heard, David, is we were not allowed to speak out and just do whatever we wanted. We had to build this league from the ground up and build it with equity so that you guys could cash in on it. And not just from the standpoint of them making the max contracts, but from them having the social capital of it, because they weren't necessarily quiet, but they had to be, like you said, they had to be welcomed as black faces into white homes. And to do that, you had to start building equity from zero. It's almost like, you know, starting off from like Reconstruction and Jim Crow and everything. Like, it's not literally the same thing, but it's you're starting from a negative point and having to build and hoping that the generations that come behind you are cashing in on it in a positive way. By and large, do you feel like this generation of player understands and appreciates what the groundwork had been laid before them? Because like you said, how would they know unless someone told them?
I mean, it's my hope. You know, my hope is that, you know, I think one of the things that's that is interesting to me is that, you know, I feel like maybe it's my imagination, but I feel like we came up in an era of just like basketball player knuckleheads. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just a basketball player scandal, suspension. This is before social media, you know? And so I feel like there's a lot of players who sort of understand where they are in life and what they can do and what they can contribute. You know, I think that we saw a lot of that, the stuff in the bubble. We saw some of this movement type of stuff from players, but obviously there's desire to want more. I mean, I think everybody could do a little bit more and everybody could do something. My hope is that these younger players can carry on and go to where, you know, I think everybody kicks in the door a little bit, you know, everybody kicks in the door a little bit, you know, for Magic Johnson, who was never really this outspoken movement activist type of person. He's important for black folks in a lot of ways, even down to the business aspect of it, you know, and you can quibble about Jordan and all that stuff. But, you know, LeBron took it further and Wade and all those people took it further. They did things 2020. And my hope is that the next generation of players go even further than that, because right now, sometimes you feel like WNBA players are the ones that's carrying the bag with all this stuff. I don't know if we will see NBA players do what the Atlanta Dream did to Kelly Loughlin, and that's the thing that's sometimes can be disheartening, is that, you know, these players who, you know, you suspend a WNBA player for 10 games, they're going to feel it. You know, that's something that
they're going to do something about it.
Right. That impacts something. That impacts them financially in a way that NBA players, most NBA players are not getting, you know? And so my hope is that a lot of these players can find the method, can find the way to sort of, you know, first of all, get educated on this stuff. Because a lot of times, and that's not to disparage them at all, but, you know, that takes a lot of reading. It takes a lot of keeping up with stuff. It takes a lot of talking to scholars and all that stuff to even be informed on the things that are going on for anybody, let alone somebody who's traveling 82 times, playing 82 games in a 6-month season and just wants to kind of go to sleep. You know, like, that is a hard thing for them to do. But, you know, my hope is that there is some sort of apparatus for them to sort of feel empowered to say what they have to say and do it in a way that's impactful.
Yeah. And think about it. The Clippers with Donald Sterling, and that was 2014.
Yeah.
And in that playoff series, the Clippers against the Golden State Warriors, where Donald Sterling's the video or the audio of Donald Sterling came out.
Right.
And, you know, it was Chris Paul. It was Stephen Curry on the other side. They were debating whether we're playing games.
Right. Yeah.
And it didn't, I don't know if it turned out to be a seminal moment, but it was certainly something that struck a chord with a lot of people. And you can say Donald Sterling became $4 billion richer. Absolutely right. He did. You can't stop racist white men from being wealthy. But from the NBA standpoint, you took away the thing that made him, that brought him the most joy, which was being a rich man that people knew and actually liked, and he could walk into a building and be something. And the same thing for the Atlanta Dream and what they did. They literally, those players, literally turned the fortunes of an election down there. And very rarely do you see that type of mobilization, because the world is too big now. With social media and everything else, the world is too big. It's hard to get people on the same page. And I'll close with this point. And this is, I would say, for all of David Stern's flaws, and maybe this is even something that Adam Silver hasn't quite figured out yet. And I'm going to see if you agree with me on this one, because I feel like we've recognized this in our, in the part of our lives. There's different types of people that you run across. There's the people who will rock with you no matter what you do, right? You're going to have these people in your corner. You can, they'll catch you hitting somebody in Central Park. You ain't do it. That type of thing. There's the people on the other side. You can save five babies from a burning building. You will still be the worst person on earth. And then there's the people in the middle, the people who you can win over, the people who can be swayed to come to your side of things. I feel like that was, A, that was the genius of David Stern, was realizing, okay, these people can be won over. I can get these people. I can help grow the league. I can help figure these things out. And these guys, these people aren't as bad as they think they are. Maybe they are, but they'll come over and like us for 2.5 hours. And I feel like in our own sort of ways, David, we're figuring out who these people in the middle are and who are the people that cannot be reached.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, in terms of ratings, in terms of all that stuff, in terms of Adam Silver's bottom line, like the thing that I think that he kind of has to understand is that racists and white supremacists have no conviction, right? They got no conviction. They have no fight because they ain't fighting for nothing. They're fighting for they're fighting for just like, I want to be better. They're fighting, I don't want these books in my thing. I don't want like gay beer or whatever they're fighting about. But the thing is,
I forgot about the gay beer thing.
Like they're fighting for all these things that don't mean anything.
Right.
Like we as black folks are fighting for our lives. Dr. King was fighting for his life. And so these people who have like, I don't want to watch the bubble because they have Black Lives Matter on the court. Guess what? They still watching the bubble because they have no conviction. They don't even have it in their soul and their spirit to boycott nothing because they ain't about nothing, right? So you're going to, so there's no really no need to convince those people to watch because they gonna watch anyway because they'll never boycott nothing because they never boycott nothing in their life because their lives have never been in jeopardy or danger to begin with. So there's no need to appeal to them because they ain't going nowhere anyway because they just bunch of, they ain't about nothing.
We gonna do this like we were at, if we were at a poetry slam. David Dennis Jr., y'all.
Yes, sir. That's how we do it. Happy MLK Day, all those who celebrate.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is David Dennis Jr. I'm encouraging everybody to pick up a copy of The Movement Made Us, a father, a son, and a legacy of a freedom ride. Also worth your time if you're listening to this podcast and might be interested in listening to something else. Check out his very good Rap Stories podcast David hosts, where he goes on with various figures and talks about the processes of the different albums and how they come together and everything else. That was really, really well done, David. I meant to say that at the top. I really appreciate you. And thanks again to producer John and to the entire team who works hard behind the scenes on this podcast. Dan will be back with another episode of Divine Intervention tomorrow, and I will be back on Wednesday for another episode of The Good Word. Until then, everybody be safe.